This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back. This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley. Coming up on today's episode, it's the morning after the night before. It was the Times Radio hustings. John Pienaar going toe-to-toe with Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak. So on the podcast today, we'll bring you bang up to date. Maybe you listened to the whole thing. Maybe you only caught a couple of clips. Well, we bring you Pienaar Unpacked. No PMQs because we don't have a Prime Minister. So instead, Patrick McGuire joins me to analyse the key exchanges. What did we learn? Particularly some movement, it seems, on from Liz Truss, particularly when it comes to tax and spend, which will be interesting because that's another change for her. So that's coming up in just a moment on the podcast. Before that, though, we kick off with our columnist panel. No Alice Thompson today. So instead, Robert Crampton's joined by Laura Freeman.
The Columnists on Times Radio.
Yes, no Alice Thompson today. We don't know where. Last week she was sitting on hay bales. We don't know where she is this week. But Robert Crampton's here. Morning, Robert.
Morning again.
Nice to see you. And we've also got Laura Freeman. Morning, Laura.
Morning.
Are you sitting on a hay bale today?
No, I'm sitting on my bed because my flat is under dust sheets while we deal with damp coming through the ceiling.
Oh, God.
Yes, I'm down to one room.
Blimey, O'Reilly's. Blimey. Well, best of luck with that.
I'm surprised there's any damp around at all.
Yeah, exactly. You thought you should have been dried right out.
Yeah.
I know.
But anyway, in fact, let's talk about that. Because there's been this phenomenon of autumn in August, Laura, I'd sort of dimly, until you said you wanted to discuss this, I hadn't really clocked how it is so obvious we're having autumn right now, whether it's, you know, brown leaves or blackberries or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, it struck me very much last week when I was walking through Hyde Park, and it was quite a blustery day, and just in any leaves that were left on the trees were sort of blowing down, and it was very weird to have that kind of hot August sun, you know, not crisp autumn blue skies, but basically to have this kind of leaves crunching underfoot. And I know there's always a bit of kind of, you know, seasonal mishmash, you know, that, you know, you want to buy a kind of bikini and a caftan at this time of year and the shops are all full of anoraks and cashmere scarves. But I feel kind of this year it's just kind of stranger than ever that we don't really know where we are.
Have you clocked it, Robert?
Yes, I have, because I live on a park, and so you can't not notice it. It's connected to the water shortage, as I understand it.
Yeah, yeah.
The trees are trying to save water, so getting rid of their
leaves.
That's
what they get rid of their leaves. It's a natural thing to do.
Yeah, and the leaves, if you notice, are just completely desiccated. I mean, they're just crumble. They're not like normal autumn leaves.
No, you don't get all the nice colours. We've gone straight to crunchy.
Yeah, and we're not getting the benefits of. I mean, it's still very humid, and we're not getting, as Laura says, we're not getting the benefit of nice kind of crisp autumn days. It's a mess.
But there's a knock-on effect then, because basically, I think it's Devon Wildlife Trust have been saying that, you know, animals that need nuts and berries, you know, there's less of them around.
Yeah,
they're definitely around at the wrong time.
It's a poor crop.
I clocked you. When was it? I was either walking the dog or going for a run, and there was a woman near me, and she'd got one of those like litter picker grabbers.
Mm-hmm.
But she was using it to reach into a bush to pull a great big hanging bundle of blackberries
closer
cheating. To her.
That's cheating.
So that she could eat them.
That's cheating.
I thought, that's planning ahead.
Yeah, I'm not sure I approve of that.
I, I say this with feeling as someone who's 5'3", but the ripest blackberries, they're always just that little bit out of reach. So I kind of quite like the idea of the litter picker.
Yeah. Although the best blackberries are the ones, which, you know, you have to get a certain amount of scratches up your arms to to appreciate that. It'd be interesting. I imagine at some point we'll be told that, you know, that we've got a lower number of hedgehogs and all that sort of thing.
Apparently, yeah, the full consequences will be revealed in the spring.
Yeah.
It's just another example of the fact that global warming is not something that's in the future anymore, is it?
It's right here. Let's talk about, because it was slightly weird, partly because we were doing Food Week last week, but we hadn't really talked about it on the show, but Sanna Marin, the Finnish Prime Minister, has now apologised after two of her celebrity friends were photographed topless behind the desk in her office. Mm. I mean, part of me thinks, I mean, come on, you're not even doing this in lockdown. You're not doing this properly. If you want a Prime Minister making merry in your office. But it's sort of weird, isn't it? Because on the one hand, she's had some criticism, but it feels like, as is quite often the case with a anger on Twitter story, there are far more people saying, why does everyone leave her alone than there are people not leaving her alone, Robert?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote a leader about this on Saturday, the Times editorial.
The Voice of the Times.
The Voice of the Times, and the headline was Party on Sanna, so where we stand. But now this next thing has come out. They weren't this precisely topless. They had a sign over their chests which said Finland. I think I can't get worked up about this either, I'm afraid. I think it seems that it's a consequence of being friends with a couple of influencers, by the sound of it, who are a little bit promiscuous in their Twitter, in their Instagram content. And maybe she needs to sort of rein them in a little bit. But I'm not going to be censorious about it because it frankly doesn't bother me.
Laura, do you buy the idea that she's getting more criticism because she's a woman than if it was a man, he'd be sort of absolute lad?
I think it's worse than that. Not only is she a woman, she is a thin and pretty woman who kind of can dance quite well. And I think we're prepared to kind of slightly roll our eyes about, you know, Michael Govan and Aberdeen nightclub and be a little bit indulgent of the dad dancing. But I think because Sanna, you know, she's a little bit sexy, she's, you know, a bit fun and a bit naughty. That's, I think somehow it sort of, you know, pushes more buttons in a way.
I suppose maybe there's a point of that. She's sort of doing it too well. She seems a bit glamorous and... it's always weird, isn't it? Because actually, Boris, you could totally see Boris Johnson doing this, aside from the lockdown parties thing.
Yeah.
But he basically could. Is. All the folks we've been seeing, he's having his holidays with his mates.
With his much younger mates. Well, with Carrie's mates, I think. Yeah.
Who've been running the country up until now.
Yes, indeed.
It's almost like there might be a connection between...
Yeah.
If you hire a load of teenagers, you wouldn't trust to run Top Man.
I know. I think, I mean, I'm never sure with these outrage stories how many people are actually.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. Yeah.
Being outraged.
It becomes a sort of a culture war.
Yeah.
It's entirely one sided with everyone saying, leave her alone.
Yeah.
And nobody's saying, she should resign.
I can't see it. I mean, I look at all the below the line comments on that leader and also on the story today, and Times readers are just pretty unmoved by this, you know. I mean,
we always say we want our leaders to be normal, Laura, well, and actually this is authentically normal, you know. Women of her age have fun.
Well, I say this as a woman who's 2 years younger than Sanna and who loathes going to parties, but I defend the right of others to go to parties, and I will do so to the death. I think it kind of plays into this whole thing. I think we're just really anti-fun at the moment. I mean, every time you sort of do anything joyous, someone will say, well, don't you know there's a famine in Yemen, and don't you know there's a climate emergency, and don't you know the winter is coming and fuel bills are rising? And it's as if that any kind of joy must be squished immediately because it's inappropriate or out of place.
Hey, this is a very puritanical time. I made the point in the leader about Churchill, who was sort of half sozzled on brandy and champagne throughout the war and giving dictation to female secretaries from his bed or his bath, and it wouldn't have lasted a week, would he? In this current culture, and he did okay. So, you know.
And actually, I mean, weirdly, last week we were doing the Food Week stuff, and I was doing the videos of me making David Cameron's pasta and all that. A lot of people just thought it was funny, you know, in Dave Gordon Brown's. Well, you tried the Gordon Brown's rumble thumbs.
Yeah, yeah, it was pretty. I liked it. Yeah.
I still got a few, like a handful of people on Twitter saying, "Oh, don't you know that people can't even afford to eat? Why are you mucking?" I can assure you, none of the food went to waste. Well, some of the rumble thumbs might have done, but all the rest of the food.
Yeah, well,
was
it wasn't my doing. I was just going to take some away. But
do you know what I mean? That's sort of like, you know,
there's always people who are going to moan. Yeah. I mean, exactly. I write columns making fun of myself, and then I get criticised for the precise thing that I've been making, you know, fun of myself about. Yeah. Social media is an enabler to for people to do that. And it used to be more difficult in the past. You had to go and post a letter.
Let's go back to posting letters.
Yes.
although I enjoyed actually the Tory hustings last night. The bloke, when he was doing the introduction, said you can still vote online or by post. Make sure you put a stamp on it. Ringing endorsement of the ability to Tory members. And then basically pointed out, there are strikes this weekend as well. So, online.
You probably can't vote by post.
I wonder whose fault the strikes are. another thing, Laura, we should talk about this. So not only is it very dry outside, we've talked a lot about water and hose pipe bans and all that sort of thing. I had no idea about another thing, which is using up all the water.
Well, yeah, this is fascinating. So apparently, you know, all around our major cities, there are these data centres where I don't really understand it, but all your data that's stored on a cloud is partly being stored, you know, in these big machines that have to be kept cool. And they're using, you know, vast quantities of water. And the issue is apparently they're using drinking water, which should be clean. And, you know, there's talk about could they use water that, you know, is not drinking water, that, you know, hasn't been filtered. It's incredibly wasteful.
And what's the water being used for?
To keep the machines cool.
Just literally cooling them.
Yeah, because I think, you know, rather like your fridge gets incredibly hot at the back. Yeah. I think all electrical appliances can heat up.
It's like a car engine. You have to be water cooled or air cooled, doesn't it?
And they also use phenomenal amounts of power as well.
Well, if you cut down the water, then you have to turn up the fans, don't you?
Yeah.
But it is bizarre that first of all that they're using drinking water.
Yeah.
And secondly, that the water isn't just going around. You'd think it would just be the same water going around in a loop.
You'd have thought,
do you know what I mean?
Maybe we need to build these data centres near the sea.
Well,
there was a really intriguing story, I'm afraid, in a rival paper a couple of weeks ago, which was about siting these data centres next to leisure centres because apparently the excess heat could be used to heat swimming pools.
What a good idea.
Which is one of my great guilts is that I swim a couple of times a week at the local Nuffield Health Centre, which is good for my back but bad for the planet and my conscience. But I think if my guilt could be assuaged by the fact that the local data centre was heating the pool that I'm in having my nice swim in, that would be so much better.
If that's all you've got on your conscience, Laurie, you're leading a pretty blame-free life.
It'd be much worse if you're going wild swimming and banging on about it the whole time.
No, I like my chlorine and my shower afterwards.
Quite right too. But it is interesting because there's this whole argument as well, isn't there, about how, you know, streaming and the internet just actually adds massively. We think it's much better because we're everything's online these days.
Yeah. But it's still
producing CDs and DVDs and VHSs.
It's still producing enormous amounts of power. Yeah, I didn't realise the extent of it. But
I wrote a piece last week for Times 2 on NFTs, those kind of artistic non-fungible tokens. And someone I was talking to was saying, you know, the kind of amount of energy that, you know, supports kind of Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies that with which you buy these NFTs is equivalent to sort of the annual output of a country like Finland. So all this online stuff is incredibly... back to Finland.
Yeah.
Incredibly energy hungry.
Exactly. And more to the point, I still don't really understand what an NFT is. And I think I read your piece, Laura, because it was...
Yeah, I read it
too. I don't understand why the art... Because I thought when it was like basically... you know, the sort of lad, you know, it's borderline, you know, basically go from like gaming to gambling to NFT. Fine.
Yeah.
That's not why we're not otherwise sensible, creative types of getting rid of it. I still don't really understand what the point of them are. It's like hedge funds. Remember during the financial crash, everyone had to explain what a hedge fund was. And I'd always read them and I still wouldn't really.
The problem is it doesn't stick. There's some stuff that you think that, I understand that perfectly well. And then 5 minutes later, you don't.
Yeah.
Is this sound Bitcoin? I'm pleased about Bitcoin, though, because I'd always thought it looks like a ripoff. And now it turns out it was.
Turns out it's a total waste of time. Bitcoin, it's a total waste. On the subject of the Sanna Marin, the Finnish Prime Minister, it's nothing to do with her being a woman, says Stephen. You can't stay out till 5 a.m. and then do your work at 9. I beg to differ, Stephen. You're just not doing it properly. Need some more Jaeger bombs. Laura Freeman and Robert Crampton. And of course, you can read Robert in The Times every week. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next, it's Pinot Unpacked.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk.
You're listening to the Redbox Podcast. Now it's time for this.
Pienaar, unpacked on Times Radio, unpacking the politics and cutting through the crossfire.
Yeah, so as you all probably know by now, unless you've been living under a stone, John Pienaar hosted the Times Radio Tory Leadership Hustings in Birmingham last night. So what we thought we'd do is unpack it. Normally with PMQs, we pause it live. We didn't do that last night because that would annoy everyone else listening to Times Radio if we started mucking about with it. But we've got Patrick Maguire here, Times Radio Box Editor. Hello, Patrick.
Afternoon, Matt. How are you?
I don't think I've seen you since you covered the show in my absence. So
no, it's been a long time.
Well done for not breaking anything. And don't push that chair back and break that screen like you did the last time you were in here. We've had to sack three assistant producers to try and replace that screen. So. Now, what did you make overall of the debate before we get into the sort of nitty-gritty?
Well, as I think Danny Finkelstein and I both observed, watching it is by now sort of a slightly uncanny, slightly wearying experience because we've heard a lot of the lines before, but that's not to say it wasn't particularly revealing. Two things were revealing. One, what Liz Truss said about the NHS, and the second thing is Rishi Sunak, bizarrely for a man who's so far behind and is staring down the barrel of the end of his career in frontline politics, at least for the foreseeable future, it's like a man possessed. He speaks with a confidence and brio, which, yes, at once is a bit, a bit Anthony Joshua at the end of his fight on Saturday night, or for political nerds, many of whom were listening to the show, a bit like Howard Dean. Remember the Democratic contender for the US presidency in 2004, and he was sort of, after he came third in a very early primary after being written off, he said, "Oh, we're going to go to West Virginia," and then started screaming, literally started screaming. And there was an air of that. But Rishi Sunak, I think, is a man who's very confident that he will be vindicated, if not by the result, yeah, by how Liz Truss's premiership is likely to unfold.
We'll dive in a moment to some of those policy things. But, I mean, as we've been talking about this morning, we've had the news this morning, a 35-year-old man has been arrested this morning in connection with that shooting in Liverpool in which the 9-year-old Olivia Pratt-Corbell died. The 35-year-old man appears to be the target of the gunman. He's in hospital. He's been arrested for breaching his licence. But it's one of the interesting, because when you become Prime Minister, you're going to have to react to things that happen in the news, and how you react will often come to define your premiership. So both candidates were asked about the killing of Olivia Pratt-Corbell and the state of policing in the country. This is what Liz Truss had to say.
First of all, my thoughts go out to the family, and it's an absolutely appalling crime, and appalling murder that took place in Liverpool. Yes, we do need to see more police on our streets. It's about recruiting more officers, but it's also about making sure those officers are focused on the crimes we care about and the public care about. I would introduce league tables so the public have a better way of looking at how their local force is performing. And, we need that change in the culture driven by, police and crime commissioners, driven driven from the top.
And then this was what Rishi Sunak had to say, actually reflecting on the fact that his own daughter is also 9 years old.
I read it and I was, you know, I called my wife and spoke to my daughter, actually, is what I did when I found out about it earlier on today. And my, you know, my heart goes out to her family, as I'm sure it does from everybody here tonight, about grappling with a loss like that. What can we do, in government to try and prevent things like that from happening? Yes, it's about putting more police officers on the street, and we've got a plan to do that. But it's also making sure...
But more than I've proposed so far.
Well, I mean, at the moment, we need to finish putting 20,000 more on the streets. But I think, actually, we need to make sure that they're focused on the right things and that we're using their time effectively and we're using the best techniques that are available to policing.
It's interesting, Patrick, they both use this sort of formulation of trying to suggest that the police, and a lot of it goes to this, all this lefty woke nonsense and all that, but trying to suggest the police aren't focused on the crimes that we care about or the things or the right things.
Well, that's a Tory tactic as old as time. It's like, John Major or Margaret Thatcher running on a platform in 87 and 92 of saying, well, your police or your council officers are spending too much time. You know, it's like Margaret Thatcher used to say this about the GLC all the time. You know, the reason your bins are overflowing is because the bin men are on basket weaving and yoghurt knitting courses. And that's exactly the same sort of thing you hear.
So it's not that we need more police, although there's intrinsic in their promise of more police is reversing, as we heard from the Liverpool Police and Crime, Merseyside Police and Crime Commissioner earlier. She said, we do need more officers. They took 1,400. We're getting some of them back, but we're still short of even getting back to where they were in 2010.
And this is the thing. This is before Liz Truss or indeed Rishi Sunak get onto their own priorities, and you speak to Tory MPs, particularly those who were elected for the first time in 2019, this is the first thing they'll tell you. They need to deliver what Boris Johnson promised, that tripartite promise, get Brexit done, more money for the NHS, and 20,000 police on the streets. The second thing, just briefly, that I heard neither of them refer to, and it's very much odds or cuts across their tough-on-crime rhetoric, both of them have majored on that throughout the campaign, is what they're going to do about the barrister strike, this indefinite strike by criminal barristers. Because it's all very well and good saying we're going to be tough on crime, but people are already waiting 2 years, 3 years for criminal trials. And if barristers aren't taking on new work, then what's going to happen? Witnesses are going to pull out of cases. Trials are going to collapse. Lots of crimes won't come to trial.
And actually what you end up with is a lot of innocent people end up in prison on remand for a very long time waiting for their cases. And a lot of guilty people end up walking the streets awaiting a trial. It cuts both ways. It's an interesting point you make about that. But let's dive in, because clearly one of the biggest issues, the biggest issue facing the country right now is the cost of living. Front page stories this week, 18% interest rates by next year on some predictions. But Liz Truss, having been criticised by Rishi Sunak on this programme, when she told me she was neglecting pensioners, remember he said that in particular she was just ignoring pensioners, it was interesting. This is what Liz just said when she now, without giving any specifics, committed to helping them.
Now, of course, in any fiscal event, a chancellor has to look at people on fixed incomes. And I've already committed to the triple lock for pensioners. I've already committed to a temporary moratorium on the green energy levy, which would take money off everybody's fuel bills. But as you rightly say, we are not going to sit here today, John, and write the budget. But what I fear has been missing from the economic discourse is, first of all, dealing with growth getting growth going, because without growth, we are in an even worse position.
Interesting that, saying that people on fixed incomes would get some help. She's also, a bit later on, they're talking about the NHS. One of Liz Truss's big commitments has been to reverse the national insurance rise, which Rishi Sunak put in place, to raise extra money for the NHS and then later for social care. Well, her very own John Pienaar asked her whether if you scrap the national insurance rise, that means there's no money for social care.
So I still would spend the money. I would just take it out of general taxation rather than raising national insurance. But I would spend that money in social care. The fact is, quite a lot of it has gone into the NHS. I believe it should go to local authorities to deal with the very real issues in social care, because the problem we've got at the moment is people are in beds in the NHS who would be better off in social care beds. So put the money into social care, free up more space in the National Health Service, and empower the front line in the National Health Service, because there are still too many central diktats going to the front line. People on the front line feel disempowered. We're seeing increasing numbers of people leaving the profession So those are the issues we need to deal with.
Two quick takeaways from that, Patrick. Saying, of course, in any fiscal event, notably not an emergency budget, a chancellor has to think about people on fixed incomes. But that clearly wasn't what she was planning to do, because originally she said no handouts. It was all about tax cuts.
And also, look at that language. The specific question John Pienaar asked was, do you commit to shielding them from the increase in the energy price cap? That's quite a specific answer. He was essentially asking her, will you at least match what Keir Starmer is proposing to do? She said, I'm going to look at helping them. That is not the same as wiping out the brunt of the impact, right? She's committing to the principle of help. We have no detail about what she's going to propose.
And then on the national insurance rise, I mean, it's essentially economic gobbledygook, this, that she says she's going to cut the national insurance rise, that was going to raise the extra money for the NHS. So the rise isn't going to go ahead, but she's going to fund it anyway out of general taxation, even though she's also committed to cutting the amount you raise from general taxation, but to give people tax cuts.
In fairness to Liz Truss, the principle she identifies, which is that the health and social care levy should be going to social care, that's the entire point of this manifesto busting tax rise, that's fair enough. But that was the point of levying an additional how many points on national insurance.
Because it comes from back in the days of the pandemic where everyone suddenly realised, blimey, social care's a mess, isn't it? Maybe we should do something for that. There was some public willingness towards it.
So she's essentially saying, well, no, that it's not right to use the social care levy for the NHS backlog. So I'm going to spend that $13 billion, but I'm also cutting the tax that the $13 billion is coming from. And by the way, I'm also, of course, going to spend to clear the NHS backlog. Well, where's that money coming from? Either you're going to introduce swinging cuts to public services, which, in fairness, Margaret Thatcher, her idol, did, but she was always honest about that. She said the country needed a short shock of monetarist medicine. Yeah. Or you're going to borrow loads, which she's not being honest about.
Well, there we are. So that's Liz Truss's economic plans. Let's turn then to Rishi Sunak. He said, I mean, this is the strongest I think he's been on Liz Truss's plans, that he thinks that Liz Truss's plans will see the Tories lose the next election. Let's take a listen.
If I don't win this, and that's the plan that we carry on with as a party, millions of people are going to face the risk of destitution this winter. Literally millions. And if we don't do anything to avert that, I think it will be a moral failure of the Conservative government, and I don't think the British people would ever forgive us. And if I'm Prime Minister, I will not let that happen.
That's pretty strong. I mean, for a former Chancellor who sat around a cabinet table with Liz Truss to say, you are going to plunge millions of people into destitution. I mean, literally weeks before that's going to happen.
Yeah, it is. And that's Rishi Sunak's big pitch to the membership. I was the man who presented that happening during COVID.
Yeah.
And it's telling, by the way, that Liz Truss has grown in confidence on every subject apart from the economy, where she seemed cagey, she seemed evasive, she was imprecise, she was palpably uneasy when asked to flesh out the specifics, in a way that Rishi Sunak was more than happy to attack that on the front foot.
Yeah. Well, needless to say, you mentioned Margaret Thatcher a minute ago. Her name was dropped a lot last night. Liz Truss, who, let's not forget, has worn the fashion of the 1980s. She literally wore a tank at one point. But anyway, she tried to play it all down. Apparently, the comparisons between her and Margaret Thatcher are all just nonsense.
You have invited, haven't you, comparisons with Margaret Thatcher?
I haven't invited them. The media constantly go on about it. And look,
but I believe you welcome the comparison.
Because frankly, every woman in politics gets compared to Theresa May or Margaret Thatcher because there haven't been as many women leaders as men leaders.
Literally wore a tank. I know. She went out of a tank.
She went to Estonia for the sole purpose
of tank.
Compared to Margaret Thatcher.
Went to Moscow and wore a big hat. Anyway, Rishi Sunak then, got in on the act of name-dropping Margaret Thatcher as well.
You know, there's been a lot of talk in this leadership election about Margaret Thatcher and rightly so, because she's our greatest post-war prime minister. But I reflect on it and I think, well, what actually was Margaret Thatcher's most important legacy? Why is it that she's so revered? Now, you could say, well, it's because she took on the unions, because of her economic reforms, because she spread home ownership far and wide. Now, all those things were important, but I don't actually think that's why she's revered. I think it's because of her character. And she was prepared always to take difficult decisions. She was prepared to say the things that might be difficult that the country needed to hear. She wasn't prepared ever to make a promise that she couldn't keep. That's what I think Margaret Thatcher was about, and that's a standard that I hold myself to.
I'm Margaret Thatcher. No, I'm not Margaret Thatcher. Stop saying I'm Margaret Thatcher, but I am Margaret Thatcher. No, I'm Margaret Thatcher.
And there's a reason why. I think the more apposite comparison for both of them at this point in the race is Ted Heath. You had Paul Johnson from the IFS.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Saying Liz Truss's policy, her likely policy of borrowing lots and slashing tax is more redolent of Heath in those years of stagnation in the early 70s. And Rishi Sunak is starting to sound like, just like Ted Heath, a man who is absolutely sure his female rival is going to self-implode. And I think he sounds like a man who isn't going to flounce off to California. He's going to sit on the back benches. Yeah. And he is going to take great pleasure in every stumble Liz Truss makes, especially on the economy, because he's now sitting there prophesizing it. That's the point of all these strident interventions at this point.
It's interesting. We had this conversation. Your friend of mine, Henry Steffen, was on earlier in the week, and we were talking about what Rishi Sunak might do next. And I said, look, he could sit, wait for her to lose the next election, become leader of the Conservative Party in opposition. He could still be Prime Minister before he's 50, because he's so, you know, if he's in the long-term game, it's not impossible. Anyway, we'll continue unpacking. It's Pienaar Unpacked. It's John Pienaar's efforts to try and get some sense out of Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak at last night's Times Radio Tory leadership hustings. We'll do some more of that after this.
We're going to South Carolina and Oklahoma and Arizona and North Dakota and New Mexico. We're going to California and Texas and New York. And we're going to South Dakota and Oregon and Washington and Michigan. And then we're going to Washington, D.C. to take back the White House. Yeah!
So Rishi Sunak is somewhere between that. And remember that line from The Office where Brent is reeling off, you know, Didcot, Yateley, Winnersh. Rishi Sunak is between those two stools.
Well, in fact, in his video, we'll talk about his video in a minute, that it had a whole list of, like, market towns. That was obviously Howard Dean there claiming he was going to march on the White House. It's Matt Chorley, still joined by Patrick McGuire, Times Red Box editor. We're doing Pienaar Unpacked, unpacking last night's Tory leadership hustings, hosted by Times Radio with our very own John Pienaar, acting as ringmaster. And perhaps one of the most telling, apart from the economic stuff, in terms of, you know, needling out a new news line from a couple of people who have been pretty determined not to, was John Pienaar asking Liz Truss about appointing a new ethics advisor, given that Boris Johnson's, well, he lost two of them and didn't bother replacing the second one. He asked Liz Truss if she would appoint a new ethics advisor to restore trust in politics.
Well, I do think there need to be proper whistleblowing procedures. You know, I would put in place, if I was elected as Prime Minister, a strong chief whip. I would return them to number 12 Downing Street, so they are at the heart of government and making sure that there is zero tolerance for misbehaviour.
What about the ethics advisor, Liz?
But I do think one of the problems we've got in this country and the way we approach things is, you know, we have numerous advisors and independent bodies and rules and regulations. For me, it's about understanding the difference between right and wrong. And I'm somebody who has always acted with integrity. I have always, you know, been clear about what I will do and followed through on my promises and been honest about the situation. And that is what I would do as Prime Minister. And I don't think you can outsource ethics.
The answer is no. Yes, John points out, the answer there is no. But at least the chief whip's on the move. Number 10, 12 Downing Street.
Yeah, it'll be so Therese Coffey will be, and her karaoke machine will be in easy reach. Shades of, you know, something a bit Nixonian about that. You know, it's not unethical. You know, as he said, it's not illegal if the president does it. And Liz Truss's stance there is it can't be unethical if the prime minister does it. And by the way, I'm culture set from the top, and don't worry, I'm proper ethical.
I'm proper ethical, me, so I don't need an ethics advisor. I mean, the main point, actually, the ethics advisor is to advise the prime minister about the ethics of other people. You know, ministers who break the code and all that sort of stuff. It's not just, you know, it's not like saying that the Prime Minister doesn't have, we assume the Prime Minister's got ethics. It's to advise on other matters of propriety.
And the Common Standards Committee has recommended, the Committee on Standards in Public Life have recommended that the ethics advisor, and this is what John Pienaar asked, should be given the power to initiate investigations by themselves, not having to go cab in hand to the Prime Minister.
So if a story comes out saying ex-minister took some money from someone they shouldn't have done, the advisors should be able to launch their own investigation rather than wait for the Prime Minister to ask.
Or say, for instance, the Foreign Secretary, whoever that may be, hosted a load of events at a Tory donors club wooing MPs for their leadership campaign without necessarily declaring where that hospitality might have come from. And so, for example, just to pluck an example out of thin air, and the Independent Ethics Advisor, the Committee on Public Standards in Public Life, thinks should be able to do that without, say, having to go to the Prime Minister who may have been Foreign Secretary.
May have been the Foreign Secretary in question.
And curiously, Liz Truss didn't answer that.
No, it's interesting that. For the sake of completeness, this is what Rishi Sunak had to say on the subject.
Yeah, I've said already very clearly that I would reappoint the independent advisor on ethics. And I would make sure that they have the powers and responsibilities to hold people to account. But look, obviously it gets set by the leader, and I would set an example.
That was Rishi Sunak saying he would appoint. But let's be honest, according to the polls, Rishi Sunak is well behind. But he's like a... In fact, can we have his video next? So this was... I'd not seen this before, partly because I'd not sat through all of these. I think this has had a couple of outings previous.
It had its debut last week.
So this is Rishi Sunak's video. It had all these sort of towns, Winners, Reading, Taunton sort of flashed up. This is his video insisting the underdog can still come through.
Underdogs don't give up. They'll do the difficult things and they never, ever get complacent. So, right, I'm off if you like. Sit back and dismiss.
So, apart from whichever Ray Winston impressionist they managed to get on the cheap, is he realistic? He's not going to win this, is he? Or is he? I mean, there is part of me that thinks it would be absolutely hilarious if he won.
It would be a disaster for the polling industry, I have to say that. And it would be a disaster for the several esteemed cabinet ministers who have made the unseemly jump from one camp to another. Look, you do speak to Tory MPs who've been at these hustings. You do speak to backers of Rishi Sunak. There is a touch of the Mandy Rice Davies. Well, they would say that, wouldn't they? Who said he's much closer? And that raises an interesting question. Let's assume Liz Truss is going to win, but she wins by a much narrower margin. She doesn't win by 80% to 20%, or even Boris Johnson's margin of 66 to just over 66 to 33. Say she wins 55-45.
Yeah. Which is possible because the polling, when Boris Johnson won in 2019, overestimated his margin by about 10 points. I think it was said he was going to win with a sort of 75-76 and he ended up with 66. Liz Truss is polling at 66. If it's 10 points out again, she's only at 56. And that's not a ringing endorsement, a mandate.
And she hasn't had a ringing endorsement for MPs. Boris Johnson won the support of well over half of Tory MPs in 2019. If Liz Truss is coming in with the support of about a third of Tory MPs and a clear but not entirely convincing victory in the membership, and you've already got Rishi Sunak inviting questions as to whether he's going to vote through her fiscal event, and you've got a very restive parliamentary party, and she's going to make a load of messy compromises that cut against her leadership platform, that's not going to do wonders for her authority in a very difficult winter, is it?
No. It'll be really interesting to see. And I mean, clearly, you know, the polls so far have been pretty consistent, but we'll find out on September the 5th. We'll be bringing that to you live. It'll be 12:30 on September the 5th. We'll bring you the results. Well, one final thing, Patrick, I wanted to discuss with you on the key question of animals. I mean, I think you can divide people into cat people and dog people. And we got a very clear sense of what was going on last night. This was Liz Truss.
I'm not a massive fan of mice, I have to say.
I'm sure.
And there are a lady in the House of Commons that I think we should have more cats.
More cats.
More cats is the answer. I'm very pleased there is a cat at number 10. So if I do become Prime Minister, at least I'll be mice free.
Yet another unfunded spending commitment for Liz Truss there.
More cats are the answer. Maybe they can join the police.
Maybe they can renovate the Commons while they're there.
And then Rishi Sunak, when talking about the Northern Ireland Protocol of all things, came down the side of dog owners.
If you want to go camping and you can't take your dog on holiday, right? Or if you're a British supermarket and it's like, hang on, I can't sell my sandwiches in every part of the United Kingdom. Those are the kind of practical things we're talking about. No one needs to have a trade war to resolve practical things like that. That's completely ridiculous.
It's the cats and dogs is what matters. What do you think happens now over the next couple of weeks? Because there's a lot of focus on what Liz Truss does, the extent to which she's gearing up. There seem to be some tensions already in her team of supporters as to what she should do on day one when it comes to the cost of living.
Well, I think the question Liz Truss is going to face again and again and again is, what are you going to do on the cost of living, both for very poorest and for middle-income families, and how quickly is it going to happen? I think the story in this morning's Times in this morning's Financial Times and also in the Times about the plan for a $100 billion two-year freeze on energy bills, I think that's going to rear its head again and again and again. And that's the only question now that matters for Liz Truss. For Rishi Sunak, I think we're going to see him make these arguments with similar panache.
Yeah. And he's now thinking about the post-defeat era of Rishi Sunak, which I agree with you. I think he'll hang around, which means, look, then I said that about David Cameron.
Well, I'll be discussing this
because he told me and then he ended up resigning. That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. And we bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not wait and review us wherever you get your podcast from?
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.